Okay, here we go. Yeah, okay. So, good evening, everybody. As you know, today is Yom HaShoah, and I thought we would spend some time studying some very interesting Shoah-related material, specifically Shelot Utshuvot, questions and answers from the Shoah period, some of them from the period of the Shoah itself, and some of them from right after the Shoah. Before we actually get into the specific questions that we're gonna learn, I wanted to share just some general thoughts about this genre of halachic literature. It is in some ways it's similar to Shelot Utshuvot, to responsa that many of us are familiar with, and that someone asks a rabbi a question, and sometimes that question comes in writing, sometimes the question comes orally, and then the rabbi writes an answer, and often records the answer, and then sometimes during the rabbi's life, sometimes after, those questions are collected, and they're published as Shelot Utshuvot, and we study them all the time, and they are a very important source of halacha in terms of precedent and how to deal with new situations that arise, right? One of the main differences between a code, like a Shulchan Aruch, and a tshuva is that a code is set, that it is what it is, it's closed after the author is done with it. Shelot Utshuvot are dynamic. They arise because questions that were not addressed directly in the codes need to be addressed. And then what happens is that those Shelot Utshuvot then become part of the new codes that are written, and then new Shelot Utshuvot come, and they're coming all the time. So on some level, Holocaust responsa are like that. They are questions that arose, but obviously, as you know, they are written under far from normal circumstances. They're all written in what we would call Shat HaDechak. They're all written in emergency situations or very, very severe situations. That's one difference. Another difference is the availability to the scholar of the literature that they need to answer the question. Oftentimes, you will see in the literature itself, I don't have my books here, but this is what I recall from the following sources, and this is the best that I can do. And oftentimes, the rabbis are sort of thrust into roles that they did not see themselves in. They're younger. For example, we're going to talk about Rabbi Ephraim Oshri, who, just by virtue of being in the Kovna ghetto and being the last rabbi standing, so to speak, became the Rav, the rabbi of the Kovna ghetto, and is probably the author of the most well-known collection of Holocaust responsa. Now, when it comes to the question of why we're studying this, the way that I like to think about Holocaust responsa is, as I mentioned, is sort of like a spiritual resistance, right? That even in the face of the most horrible conditions and the most terrible circumstances, these Jews still maintained loyalty to halacha. And they asked questions instead of saying, well, what the heck, we're going to do whatever we want. It's such an awful situation. Of course I could do whatever I want. They did not allow themselves to be brought into that situation of yeyush, of giving up hope, or of giving up fidelity to the system that they were reared on. And they maintained halachic fidelity to the halachic system. It also speaks about amazing faith. What you very rarely see in Holocaust responsa is any of the theodicy questions, right? Someone asks a horrible question, and it's not followed up with, and how can God do this to us? But since he is anyway, here's the answer. It's just presented as a question and an answer. And so for some people who are not familiar with halacha, it may come across as extreme. It may come across as very, very strange or odd. But for these people, it was halacha was their lifeblood. I saw today a statistic that half of the Jews murdered in the Shoah were observant. Right, so that's we're observant of halacha. Does that surprise you?
Is that a new
statistic? How do they know that?
That's a good question. I don't know.
That would mean that half the Jews in Europe were.
I don't know how they know that. I just saw that written in one of these collections of halacha and the Holocaust books. I'm not sure. Good question. But that's what it said.
Probably most of the Jews in the area of the Soviet Union were halacha Jews.
Right.
Not Germany.
No. But
and not Poland either.
Germany than a lot of places.
Yeah, and Poland. Yeah. Okay. Anyway, that's not the point. But so that's some aspects of Holocaust responsa. What you also get from Holocaust responsa are accounts of events that are not extant anywhere else, and we're going to see one of them today. One of the most horrific ones today, and so a lot of these Holocaust responsa contain very important historical information. You also see very clearly a concern for the psychological well-being of the questioner on the part of the rabbi, that the rabbi recognizes that the person is under incredible distress, and so the rabbi is balancing between his duty to interpret the law the way he sees it, but also recognizing that he needs to have empathy for these people who are, again, in these impossible situations. There are some excellent books that deal with the Holocaust and halacha. Three of them are, if anyone is interested, Rabbinic Responsa of the Holocaust Era, which was written by Robert Kirshner. He was a conservative rabbi who wrote about Holocaust responsa for his thesis, and then he digested it and put it into a book. There's another book called The Holocaust and Halacha by Irving J. Rosenbaum. And there's another English book called From the Depths, Mimamakim, which is a digest of Rabbi Oshri's from the Kovno Ghetto. There are four volumes in Hebrew. They've been digested. It's not all of them, but a bunch of them have been collected into an English book called From the Depths, which is the translation of Mimamakim. Or the Hebrew one is available. All four Hebrew volumes are, by the way, available for free on HebrewBooks.org. Okay, so let's get right to the first question, which was addressed to Rabbi Ephraim Oshri. Just a quick word about Rabbi Ephraim Oshri. I also learned something about him today that I did not know before. Again, he is the most well-known author of halachic responsa during the Shoah. He was living in the Kovno Ghetto, and he had many, many questions posed him, and he wrote the questions down on little scraps of paper that he could find, and then eventually buried them in the hope that he would be saved or someone would be saved and find them. He survived and then published them after the war. So from June 24th, 1941 until August 1st, 1944, Rabbi Ephraim Oshri was asked these questions by the Jews of the city. And I did not know this, but this is very interesting. Rabbi Oshri was appointed by the Nazis as one of the custodians of the warehouse of Jewish books that they had set up in Kovno, which they were probably saving for the museum of the Jews that they were planning for after the war, right? So he was in the unfortunate circumstance of being in the Kovno Ghetto, but he had access to a Jewish library, which nobody had access to, only because he was put in charge by the Nazis of this library. So he had the opportunity to access at least some of the major works of rabbinic literature when he needed to answer questions, as opposed to other rabbis who were in ghettos or concentration camps, who certainly did not have access to any of this material. Okay, So let's get right to the question that was posed to Rav Oshri. This you have available to you in this packet, the Hebrew and the English translation. So if you'd like to follow in the English, it starts on page 4. And if you'd like to follow in the Hebrew, it's on page 1. I think we're out of source sheets. So you could...
We can share. Here.
Share. Oh, I'm sorry. Here are... I'm sorry. Here are some others.
I'll share one.
And I found some more. Here are some more, if anyone needs. Glenn. There you go. Okay. All right. So... this was obviously a question that was posed to Rav Oshri after the Shoah. Nituach de lahasir hamisparim shagirmanim ha'arurim sartu al zeroe b'nei adam. Concerning the question, removing the numbers, the tattoo numbers, that the accursed Germans engraved or tattooed on people's arms. The woman wanted to remove this. And this is how the question is posed. Acharei shezachinu Hashem itbarach latzeit me'afela le'or gadol, kishenishberu motot oleinu v'nishtachrarnu mihiliot avadim la'avdei bishi yimach shemam. Right after God granted us the good fortune and we were able to take off the yoke of our servitude, may their names be blotted out. Nishalti al yedei isha achat zira liyamim uvat tovim me'achat ha'mishpachot ha'nichpadot. So the Germans engraved a tattoo on her arm. She was from a good family, a young woman, had lots of years ahead of her. She was looking forward to living her life. And she had numbers from, not every concentration camp had this practice, but she was in a concentration camp that did have this practice. And she wanted to know if she could take it off. Mispar ki kol asir hayalo mispar ulufia misparim haele heim nichtavu b'sifrei achayim v'hametim, and they would keep track of people in the camps by virtue of the numbers. Mila chayim, mila mavet. Who will live and who will die? Mi b'kitzo, mi lo b'kitzo. Right. This is from the davening on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. Who in their time and who before their time? Ela alav od lehitanot ba'avodat perech. Who are going to continue to have to suffer for hard work? Work ki al hakol nahagu hazadim ha'arurim statistica meduyeket. Right, they had very very specific statistics on how to go about on how to keep everyone keep records. V'achshav la'achar shichur b'tzona la'avir al yedei nituach plasti et hamispar hazeh ha'ma'ale lefaneha et zichron ha'imim shel hayamim hanarim ha'ele et hayta netuna bi'adam. So she wants to know if she could use plastic surgery because the numbers remind her of her terrible experience and those terrible days when their life was going to be decided for good or for bad. And she thinks that if she takes off the number, she'll be able to get some relief, some psychological relief from her depression of those bitter days, which disturbed her so much that she was not able to have any rest. It was always on her mind. Every time she looks at the number, she's reminded of her terrible experiences that she had in the camp, how they were sort of treated like animals, and how people were annihilated, and they like she said like sheep, right, who are counted, and therefore paragraph B visho elat imutarla al pi hadin lavir meal zroa et ketovet hazot ulay de kach tuchal lishkoach et kol hatzarav vehayagon. She'll find some relief for her embittered soul. Okay, that's the question. So before we see Rabbi Oshri's answer, what are your thoughts?
I'm not understanding what the actual shaila is.
That's the question.
Because what's the shaila? She's not like if she's not tattooing herself. It's asur and. Got this conformity, and she just wants to get it prepared.
So I That's a good question. I would have thought that Rabbi Oshry would address this via the question of whether or not one is allowed to injure themselves, right? Do a chabura on yourself. Are you allowed to harm yourself, which you're not allowed to do, which this would be. Now, it's true, it's for a good reason, but I thought I would think that that's how he would address it. So that would be one
I guess
question.
Also before, you know, today we think of like plastic surgery. Some woman needs, for example, a breast reduction for health and this, and
right.
give her a psychological lift. You know, so these questions are commonplace.
They are, right.
In those days.
Right. Rav Moshe Feinstein has a well-known tshuva. I think it's Rav Moshe Feinstein, addressed to a young woman who wants to have some plastic surgery because she feels that she's unmarriageable.
Whereas in those days, these were not...
And he does not address it from that angle either. Right? Okay. Good. Dov?
So I'm going to ask you a question. That's a good question. If someone converts, Jews are not to be tattooed. Someone converts and has a big tattoo, right? I love my mother. And say, now I'm going to be a Jew. I want to get rid of it.
Right.
What would you tell them?
I think I would tell them to get rid of it. But we're going to see Rav Oshry's approach. I will tell you, this is a true story. But when I was a rabbi in New York, I was involved in the conversion of a woman. And she went through the whole program. And the next day she was going to go to the mikveh. And she calls me up at night. And she says, Rabbi, I have to tell you something I've kept from you this whole time. And I'm sorry, but I need to tell you. And who knows what I was thinking. She goes, I have a gigantic tattoo of a spider on my back. And I'm going to the mikveh tomorrow. What am I supposed to do? I said, well, I'm really happy you told me. Because the Hungarian woman, who was the mikveh lady, I think would have died from a heart attack had she seen this before without being warned. I said, nothing. There's nothing you could do. I'll tell the mikveh lady. I warned the mikveh lady, and she thanked me very much, and that was the end of that. But we didn't get into the question of whether she should remove it or not. But her question was, does it create some sort of chatzitza, some sort of problem in the mikveh, which it doesn't. Okay, yes.
So what year was this tshuva asked, this question?
Unclear. It is not noted. It is printed in Pardes in Tuf Shin Chaf Aleph. So, 60 years ago, over 60 years ago. It was printed, published over 60 years ago.
But it was after the war that she'd want to remove it.
Since we're talking about psychology, which it sounds like, you know, part of this woman's psychological well-being, a lot has changed since then in terms of psychological well-being, in terms of the understanding of depression and suicide. And
that, yep.
As far as I'm concerned, to look ahead at the English. Totally disagree with him.
Well, one second. You looked ahead, so you're puzzle A just now.
Sorry.
All right, let's look at his answer.
I can give an answer. That's
let's look at his answer. Let's look at his answer. We don't know if it's Pikuach Nefesh, because she doesn't say.
But you don't know that. And
you're right.
There's a certain Hebrew term for it, and I don't remember. There's a concern, okay. For example, can a psychologist answer a phone at Shabbos?
Yeah.
And there's a certain term.
Safek pikuach nefesh. Yes, you're right.
That's it.
You're right. But let's see what he says. Let's see what he says. Okay. It's an interest. He does not take it that direction. He takes it another direction. Okay. By the way, Tufshin Chaf Hei. Tufshin Chaf Hei. Let's see. This was published in approximately March 1965. Adar Aleph Tufshin Chaf Hei, March 1965. The book was published March 1965. We don't know when the question was asked. It's not on the question. It's certainly after the war. Okay, here we go. So he gets into this quick notion, and we're just going to jump right to the English to save time. This quick notion on page 5. In Shulchan Aruch, he says the Rama ruled as follows concerning round green patches that the government has ordained all Jews to wear on their garments. It is permitted to go out on the Sabbath with these on. even if the patch is not sewn on the garment but tacked on loosely. It appears from this that if the wicked government wants to abuse Israel by requiring Jews to wear a patch of green cloth upon their garments and shame and debase them in the eyes of the Gentiles, even so the Ramah ruled in the name of the Or Zeruah that it is permitted to comply with this edict on Shabbat, for on the contrary, it honors the people of Israel, moreover the cloth is garment. The point of quoting this is to say the following, that the patch that the Shulchan Aruch is talking about, and by extension, the number that she's talking about, is not shameful. It's actually a badge of honor, is the argument that he's making. Because the fact that you're allowed to wear it on Shabbat, even though it's not a garment, because we're talking about carrying on Shabbat is the issue. No Eruv, carrying on Shabbat. The fact that you're allowed to wear this thing on Shabbat, and it's not considered carrying, right? It's not. It's considered to be something honorable, and therefore, almost like jewelry, like an adornment, and you could wear it on Shabbat.
And everybody was wearing it together.
Right. Correct.
This is not the case with this poor woman who's being burdened with this.
Well, everyone who was tattooed
was. There was a lot of people.
Right. There were.
They weren't always mixing.
Correct. That's true. Correct. But I don't think that matters. From that, I don't think that impacts his halachic thing. It might. But he's saying that it is an honor, okay? And he says, our case is the same. The Germans may their names be blotted out, tattooed this number on the arms of the Jews as a mark of disgrace that would debase them in the eyes of all who saw them. They would say those with the numbers tattooed on their arms are not considered human beings but cattle. The authorities can do with them as they wish and take them out to be killed and slaughtered like cattle. But a number like this cannot foul our spirit or debase our honor. On the contrary, this number for us is a sign of honor and splendor. And for them, the loathsome murderers, may their name and memory be blotted out. It is a reminder of their iniquity and everlasting sin, which cannot be pardoned or forgiven. Their plot to annihilate a holy nation without leaving even a remnant. For if a Jew... He goes on. So his first point is, like I said, it is a honor for the Jew to have a number, and it's degrading now to the rest of the world, right? Who let this happen, and specifically to the Nazis who did this, right? So he's addressing one concern, that the woman feels some level of embarrassment or debasement from wearing this number, and he's trying to tell her, well, there's another way to look at it, and you should wear it as a badge of honor. I will tell you that there is a movement now in Israel, I've heard of this, that grandchildren and children of Holocaust survivors who are dying are getting the same tattoos that their parents and grandparents had. I'm not talking about whether that getting tattooed is against halacha. These people aren't asking a shayla whether they can do it. But their grandparents or their parents had this tattoo. You've heard of this? And they're doing this. The same number, as much as it goes against my grain as a halachic Jew, I get that. I really, that to me is very touching.
I know a woman.
Right, that they want to honor that part of their parents or grandparents' life and not let it die with them.
But they're not depressed. They don't have a depressing memory of those good days.
You're right. I'm just pointing out that along the lines of what he's saying, it's something that is part of their memory, which they don't want to forget, as opposed to her, who does want to forget it. Okay, continuing on. Therefore, this degrading tattoo, the terrible number engraved on the arms of thousands of people who were at one time or another in the concentration and death camp, surely serves as a sign of honor and memorial. For we must remember what this German Amalek did to us. Now, here is it's a quasi-halachic argument. Like, he sneaks it in, right? We have an obligation to remember what Amalek did to us. And he's equating the Nazis with Amalek, which is a fair comparison, right? And therefore, he says, if you erase it, what he's trying to say without saying it explicitly is if you erase it, and if your purpose of erasing it is to forget, then maybe that's not really what you should do, right? There's a responsibility that she may have to remember, notwithstanding the very difficult reality that she's living through. God forbid that we should forget this and eradicate from our hearts all that these wicked ones did to us. these wild beasts in the image of man, the seed of Amalek, the descendants of Ham, and the wicked. It is our manifest and redoubled duty at this time to remember their wickedness and not to divert our minds, even for a moment, from all evil they wrought for us. So I think what he's trying to do, without explicitly saying it, he's trying to sort of nudge her to look at this from a different perspective, almost that she has a responsibility as a survivor, right, considering so many did not survive, to not do anything that will diminish the memory of the Shoah at all, right? Okay? And so that's, now I don't, I think it's hard to say ridiculous because he himself is a Holocaust survivor. No one else around, right, he is from the Kovno ghetto, and no one else of us is. So just like we should never judge the decisions. We should never judge the decisions of a Holocaust survivor. As someone who went through the Shoah, this is his perspective.
Can I just say something?
Right. But she asked him. Hold on, Stuart. One second. Excuse me. Oh. She asked him. That's his job. He's a rabbi. She asked him for an answer, and so he is giving her an answer. And so, and he himself is a Holocaust survivor.
But this is not a halachic answer. This is not based on any halakha.
Ah, right, which is very interesting.
There's no reference to any Jewish text.
Well, one second. There was at the beginning.
But that was the garment.
And, right, but he's saying, his point was that the number is an honor, just like the patch was an honor. And then he does reference a pasuk in the Torah, which is a religious text, last I checked, right? That we are not supposed to. You give me that one? Okay.
You know,
okay.
Can I just say something?
Yes, yes.
I worked at the Holocaust Museum in New York for many years. And one of the first things they taught us after a year of study, a survivor is never wrong because everybody thinks of it differently. So whatever they do is right for them.
So as much as we think that he may not be sensitive, as much as we think that he may not be sensitive to her, the fact that he's a Holocaust survivor gives me pause before judging him. And again, he was answering a question that she asked. Had a non-Holocaust survivor answered or volunteered that information without being asked, I think it would be different. But she's, again, this is the point. She actually cares about what this rabbi is going to tell her. Otherwise, she would have gone ahead and have done it. So this is part of her spiritual resistance, right? She's not going to say, well, to heck with it, I'm going to do whatever I want. She feels still totally devoted and bound by halacha.
He should have freed her and said, it is okay whatever you do.
Well, I don't think, well, that's not what he believed, it sounds like. It sounds like he believed.
She's come to him with a halachic shayla. Okay, because that's the whole genius of this, that he's understanding that this is not actually at least yet about the halakha.
Right.
I
mean, yes,
he's saying this is about how you're feeling. It is about sakha. He's giving her a pastoral.
And then he goes on. I mean, he does begin to quote other psukim in the Torah. Let the avenging of thy servant's blood that was shed be made known among the nations in our sight. For he that avengeth blood has remembered them. He goes on to quote other psukim. And at the end, he says, for this reason, God forbid, bottom of page 6, that this woman should remove the number from her arm. By doing so, she would be lending a hand to the accursed German criminals. Now, that's a very, it's
tough.
Very heavy, but from a survivor, and his view is, and when we know, right, we know that there are attempts to diminish, deny the Shoah, and this is in at least in the 60s, probably before, he's picking up on this, that this is already a possibility, and he won't have it. And what he's trying to tell her, and we do this often, he's trying to say, you have another responsibility to people other than yourself. You have a greater responsibility here. Now, it's true that from our perspective, it may lack a certain psychological sensitivity, but sometimes we also believe that that's true. Sometimes we tell our family members, our children, our students that you are one factor in this decision, but there are a lot of other people who you have responsibilities to and you have to think about them too. And he's thinking about the 6 million people who were murdered in the Shoah. And so it sounds like a bit of a guilt trip, but it is the ultimate it's the ultimate crime, and he does not that has ever occurred, and he does not want that to be forgotten. And so he could lose. On the contrary, it is her duty to bear the sign with pride and exultation. By virtue of this, she will merit to see the time when God renders vengeance. And also, he may be hoping that by altering her perspective, that she won't be depressed anymore. She's looking at it. This is shameful. This is terrible. And he's saying, no, this is a badge of honor. You should wear this. We're here. We defeated the Nazis. We survived. We have to remember. And maybe that could also, which is, by the way, also what sometimes a psychologist or a mental health professional will do. They don't always tell the person that they're right. They try to tweak the way that they're looking at it, and then they feel differently about it. And so I think that's a little bit about what he's doing here. Yeah.
If you're as old as I am, you ran into people who were out in society functioning and doing, especially if you were in Israel, who were survivors. And this position specifically is strongly fit. I had a landlord. His name was Offman.
Who?
His name was Offman.
Offman, okay.
With an olive. So I said to him, I never heard Offman. What about Offman? So he says to me, I can feel him. He said, when they took me off the train, ask me, what's my last name? This was a camp where they did by name, not by numbers. And he said, Hoffman. And he said, and the Nazi guard said, no Jew's going to have the same name I do. So he changed it to Hoffman. And then afterwards, I said to him, no, now it's only, he said, no. This is my, and he said it, this is my badge that I'm a Jew. I'm not going to have the same name as that Nazi. And he and his wife, both of whom clearly lost families. They were the only two survivors, and they were well into their 40s. They were determined to have a kid and tell the kid the story so the name Offman would go on. To feel the passion, and then there was a sadness. They had one daughter. Of course, they wanted to get married, and they wanted to. This is a strongly held belief. This has got to, right? This
right.
On the other hand, so is hers.
Yes.
And he should have said that there, but I think he should have ended it by saying, I buy this. I understand. This is what I feel. But in the end, you have to decide for yourself.
One more question.
And do it yourself. He believes.
Right. Well, I mean, the difference is, let's just remember, he's not a he's not a psychologist. He's not a psychologist. He's a rabbi. And she was asking yes or no. And his responsibility is to give her an answer.
But he's coming
right?
out of this
Rabbi, was he in
a
concentration camp too,
coming,
or just in the ghetto?
I don't.
Because by
I don't
having
know.
A number, she was not just in the ghetto, she was in a
yeah,
concentration
yeah.
camp. So maybe he couldn't maybe he
all right.
react to that.
I mean, I wish you could have seen this guy.
Right. All right. Let's move to the next one. The next one is quick, because this next one is a little long.
Okay. Bottom line is, this is a general answer. In psychology, I don't give general answers.
No, this is a specific answer to her. It's not a general answer.
No, it's still, I don't know how depressed she is.
He might have known.
I
right,
but
so that
you
can't just for you it's general, but for him he's
think he is. We're reading
we actually don't. The truth is, I don't know if you ever met her actually,
so,
because it seems like she
I,
shouldn't.
I
it wasn't addressed to her, but
me.
Yeah, okay.
People respond differently.
Let's look at this next one. This is one of the most shocking of all the Holocaust responses I've ever seen. The Hebrew begins on page 1. The English on page 7. This is written by Rabbi Tzvi Hirsch Meisels. Tzvi Hirsch Meisels was a leader of Hungarian Hasidism. He was the Rav of the city of Weizen in Hungary. I also realized before, and Dov, this may interest you, if I'm remembering this correctly, his father was the Rav of the Hungarian city, I think called Ulai, or Ulai. Which the Yismach Moshe, who is, I think, the beginning of the Teitelbaum Hasidic dynasty, was the rabbi. He's still buried. I saw his grave when I went last summer. And his father was the rabbi there. So they
is
are.
It Budapest?
It's outside about it. We drove a couple of hours out of Budapest to get there. But what's there is the Jewish cemetery, which has graves going back to the, I think, 15th century.
And the name of the city is again?
Ulai. I think. Ule. I thought I brought the information with me here. but he's a Hungarian rabbi, and before being transported to Auschwitz, he already was very, very well known, and he actually survived the Shoah, survived Auschwitz.
This is the royal title bound.
No. They're not related. They're from the same city where this famous Hasidic rabbi, one of the early members of the title-bound Hasidic dynasty, was. I do not believe they're related. So after liberation, he was appointed as the chief rabbi of Bergen-Belsen and of the British sector. And he clarified a lot of questions after the Shoah, especially in terms of allowing women to remarry whose husbands were presumably murdered in the Shoah, but it was hard to track down specific details. That's one of the most pressing type of shaylot that came out of the Shoah. This event takes place, we know exactly when this takes place because he wrote it, Erev Rosh Hashanah 1944. The English date The English date was September 17th, 1944, where this took place. The beginning of it, I'll just read you the beginning of it because the language is very, very powerful. May the generations be horrified and the consciences stirred to turn the hearts of the children to their fathers. As I tell publicly of the fearful and exalted things my eyes beheld at Auschwitz on Rosh Hashanah and Simchat Torah, the magnitude of self-sacrifice, the sanctification of God's name by 1,400 boys, 14 to 18 years old, who were chosen on the day of the eve of Rosh Hashanah in a selection to be sacrificed upon the altar to be burned for the sanctification of God's name. The way that this selection was done was that all the young men of the camp were called out to a central area, and a Nazi put a stick in the ground and attached another stick across the top of it. If you look on page 8 in the English, he draws it out. He said it looked like the letter Dalid. So it's a tall stick with a letter hanging out. And he said the Nazi commander had everyone march under this stick. And if your head did not reach the stick, you were set aside to be murdered the next day. So it was the way of getting of finding out who was young and who was old. And the older ones, I guess, were going to be kept to work, and the younger ones were going to be killed the next day. Okay? That's the backstory of what's going on here as he tells it. Okay? He says his own son was there, but who was 14, would probably not have made the cut. But he was miraculously saved. And then comes the question. Page 9. The next day, the first day of Rosh Hashanah, when all the people of the world passed before God like sheep, there was a panic and confusion. By word of mouth, the news spread throughout the camp that on that evening, they would take the boys away to the crematorium. In the case of many people in the camp, their only children, the only survivors left to them, were among these boys condemned to be burned, or else they had close relatives or beloved friends. These people ran around bewildered all day, but the kapo guards paid no attention to all their pleas and tears, and again, to save time, the kapos were responsible to make sure that no one left this barrack where these boys were being kept, and of course they were going to be counted the next day, and if the number was fewer, then the kapos were going to be held responsible. So the kapos were not letting anyone out because they had their own skin to look after. In the evening, it would be their responsibility to deliver to the SS the same number that had been delivered, top of page 10. If one was missing, they themselves would be held accountable and would be taken away to be burned, a life for a life. Even so, after much effort and bargaining between the relatives and the kapos agreed, conquered them, and they agreed in exchange for large payments to free this or that boy. But immediately they snatched another boy in their place. So if you were going to ransom someone you knew from that barrack by bribing a capo, you knew that you were also going to cost someone else their life. Because the capos were not going to have the numbers not match what they were supposed to. And then here's the question. Page 11. I was approached by a Jewish man who appeared to be a simple Jew from Oberland. In innocent piety, he said to me something like this: "Rabbi, my only son, my dear one, so precious to me, is over there among the boys condemned to be burned, and I have the ability to ransom him." Right? He must have smuggled in something. "Yet we know that without a doubt the kapos will seize another in his place. Therefore, I ask of the rabbi a question of law and practice. According to the Torah, am I permitted to save him? Whatever you decide, I will do."
Oh, wow.
And I think this is the only account in Shoah literature that we have of this. In the footnote, the author of the book that published it in English mentioned that there was a similar, identical selection took place at Auschwitz on Yom Kippur when 2,000 boys were assembled, and Dr. Mengele did that one. So this was something with the same idea of the stick in the ground that people had to pass underneath. So this was a similar thing. So it's possible that one happened on Rosh Hashanah and one happened on Yom Kippur, or it's possible that the author, Rabbi Meisels, has the wrong date and he got confused and it actually took place on Yom Kippur. It's unclear. Okay? So that's the question. We have 12 minutes. So quick. Quick. Anyone want to?
Binding of Isaac.
Yeah,
but
it does.
At that time, God, thank goodness,
God came to the rescue that time.
Came to the rescue.
Anyone want to put yourself in this rabbi's shoes for a minute?
Say nothing. No, I'll say absolutely no. I wouldn't want to be this.
Yeah. Say nothing. Okay. What's that?
I wouldn't put myself in the shoes for a middle second.
Okay. When I heard this question, says the rabbi, I was seized by trembling. Could I decide a matter of life and death? I answered, "My dear friend, how can I render a clear decision for you on a question like this? In such a situation, even when the temple stood, a question concerning matters of life and death came before the Sanhedrin. But I am here in Auschwitz, without any books of law, without any other rabbis, and without a clear mind because of so much suffering and grief. If it were the way of the wicked kapos to release the ransom prisoner first and afterward take another in his place, it might be possible to incline a lid toward permitting the ransom, since after all the kapos were Jews, and for them it was certainly forbidden by law to do such a thing with their own hands and endanger another life whose fate had not been to burn. Such an act is included in the prohibition of one should suffer death rather than transgress. If so, it's possible to assume that it was not certain the kapos would take another life." Meaning, if they first gave you your son and then went after another kid, maybe I would allow it. Because in that intervening time between when the kapo freed the boy, maybe they would have done tshuva, or I don't even want to say that because it's hard to judge
second
them.
Thoughts.
Maybe they would have second thoughts, and they wouldn't have taken another boy, and they would have said, "I'm willing to face the consequences." But apparently, it looks like they went and got the replacement before they set free the one who was ransomed. So that already is not something that he was comfortable. Paragraph 13, "However, to my sorrow, I knew with certainty that it was the kapo's practice to first take someone else from the camp and only afterward release the ransom prisoner. Thus, they would be sure that none were lacking from the exact number delivered to them by the SS for which they were responsible. Still," bottom of page 12, "the man mentioned above wept and pleaded with me. He said to me, 'Rabbi, you must decide for me now what the law is in this case. For it is very urgent that I save my only son while it is still possible to save him. I begged him, 'Dear Rabbi, precious friend, leave off from asking this question, for I cannot say anything at all to you without studying a book, especially in a situation as fearful and dreadful as this.'" So actually, he's taking your position. He's not saying anything. Okay? "But he continued to plead with me and said the following: 'Rabbi, does this mean that you cannot permit me to ransom my only child? Is it not so? Then I will accept with love the decision.'" So again, he says, "I entreated him and protested, saying, 'Dear Jew, I did not say this either. I do not permit you to ransom your child. I do not decide either yes or no. Do as you wish, as you had not asked me at all.'" Which is a remarkable thing for a rabbi to say, right? Pretend you didn't ask me and just do what you want. Now, obviously, this is probably the most, I can't imagine a more difficult question in the history of history. Right? There are questions like this from the Middle Ages and from pogroms. This is an impossible question. Do as you wish, as if you not asked me at all. But still, he stood there and pleaded with me to give him a clear answer. When he saw that I stood firm in my position and that I did not want to render a legal decision, he responded with emotion and great fervor. And this is where your plan backfires. Rabbi, I did what I could, what the Torah obligated me to do. I asked the question of a rabbi, and there is no other rabbi here. Since you cannot answer me that I am allowed to ransom my child, this is a sign that according to the law, you may not permit it. He read into the rabbi's silence. Had it been okay, Rabbi, you would have said it was okay. But the fact that you didn't say it was okay means it's not okay. Were it permitted without any hesitation, you surely would have answered me that it is permitted. This means to me that the verdict is that by law, I am not allowed to do it. That is enough for me. It is clear that my only child will be burned according to the Torah and the law, and I accept this with love and rejoicing. I will do nothing to ransom him, for so the Torah has commanded. And then the rabbi goes on. Nothing I said to him was of any use. I urged him not to lay the responsibility for this upon me, that I was as if I had never heard this question. But he repeated once again with pious fervor and weeping what he said, which tore the heart into 12 pieces. So he carried out his words and did not ransom his son. All that day of Rosh Hashanah, he walked around talking to himself, murmuring joyfully that he had the merit to sacrifice his only son to God. For even though he could have ransomed him, nevertheless he did not, because he saw that the Torah did not permit him to do so, and that his sacrificial act should be considered by God like the binding of Isaac, exactly as you said, which also occurred on Rosh Hashanah. And you, my dear brother, this is the rabbi now concluding this tshuva, look closely and consider the righteousness and perfect piety of this Jewish man. I have no doubt that his words caused a great uproar among the celestial host, and the Holy One, blessed be he, gathered together all the host of heaven and was, so to speak, very proud. Behold the creatures that I created in my world. Justifiably, it is said of this man, Israel, in you I will be glorified. And that's the end of the tshuva. There's a footnote provided by the English translator. I don't know if you have it. Where he says, no, I didn't give you that footnote. No, there's another footnote. I didn't give you all the footnotes. There's too many papers to copy. That there an eyewitness there to this conversation. Actually, he said that Rabbi Meisel's was clearer than is expressed in this tshuva, that he was not allowed to do it. Now it's unclear. It's hard to know exactly what that means. Let me see if I could find the footnote. I thought I brought it. Does anyone have the copy with the original? Oh, here it is. He says as follows. No, I don't have it. But there is another footnote that says a eyewitness to this discussion indicates that Rabbi Meisel was less equivocal than it sounds like in this tshuva. But it could be that the man also misunderstood Rabbi Meisel when he also didn't say yes. He could have also understood that meant the answer was no. And so this tshuva is, first of all, a very important historical piece of information, and it's an amazing testimony to this man's faith and his commitment to Jewish law. Right? He had it within his ability to save his son, and he thought that was against halacha because it would have meant the death of another boy. And he just didn't do it because he didn't get a clear yes from the rabbi.
And this is with couples who are doing doing just the opposite, sending other Jews to death to save themselves.
Right. Yeah. But there was no way around that. They were keeping a tight watch. Just one other point before we conclude. On 14 and 15 and 16, there's another similar question that was asked to Rabbi Meisels, which he does answer. This was an interesting question, that there was a young prodigy, I think he's 20 years old, his name was Moshe Rosenberg, who was an outstanding Talmud Chacham and a very, very pious boy, who was taken as a selection, either in this one or another one, to be murdered. And a young boy, a 15-year-old boy, comes to Rabbi Meisels from the town of Weitzen. I don't know where that is. His name was Akiva Mann. So we have all these names also, which is so important for Shoah memory. And he says, I want to go in his place. I don't know any Torah. I'm a kid. What a loss it will be for the world to lose this this prodigy. I could bribe, I have enough money to bribe the capo. And at first he doesn't let Rabbi Meisels know. He says, how are you going to do this? He goes, I have money. So then Rabbi Meisels says, but you can't do this because they're going to take someone else in there, in his place. He goes, I have a solution to that too. He says, what's your solution? He goes, I'm going to go in his place. Like he's volunteering to sacrifice himself. He says, what plan? Tell me. He replied with great fervor, the plan is that I will go instead, and I accept this with great joy to be sacrificed in this place. When I heard this, I rebuked him, telling him, certainly I will not permit you under any circumstances to place yourself in danger, for the law was long ago determined that your life takes precedence. That's a much more clear-cut situation. You're not allowed to sacrifice your life in a situation like that. That's the famous story of the two people in the desert, with only one of them has a canteen of water, and just the owner is supposed to.
What do you think got this
from Rabbi Akiva? The owner is supposed to is keep it. Yeah.
Putting yourself in that position, sacrificing yourself. Can you not do that for your child either? A child for the parents?
I don't think so. I do not think that one is permitted to do that.
How about God forbid there is an attack at a synagogue, and the rabbi tries to protect the children by sacrificing himself, like what happened in Howard?
Yeah.
I would argue the following.
I would argue the following. Two points. One he makes, one I'll make. One is fighting back against an attacker where you may be killed is different, because first of all, you may not be killed. Second of all, when you're in a milchama, and I would argue that when there's a shooter in your building, you're in a milchama, these rules don't apply. Of course, if you're a soldier, you're not supposed to say, well, that I have a gun, that guy has a gun, well, let him go first, right? In a milchama, the rules of this halacha that your life comes first doesn't apply. So I would argue that in a case like that, where you're fighting an armed person, that doesn't apply. But interesting, what he does say in a footnote is as follows. You don't have page. You don't have this. I didn't give this to you. He says as follows. In his own gloss to the account, Rabbi Meisels cites, and this goes to your question, Rick, cites the view of the Rama that one may save himself from impending danger even if his action may endanger others. However, this appears to apply only in the case of potential danger. If one is in immediate peril, he may not save himself at the certain expense of another life. So that would knock out this situation. However, then he says, the Shach cites the view that if a man is imprisoned or held for ransom, he may not be rescued if another will be seized in his place. That's the case. But according to the Yad Avraham, the prisoner himself may certainly try to escape. Right? If I'm in jail, I'm about to be murdered by the Nazis, of course I'm allowed to try to save myself. I can't do it if I know that someone's going to be... I can't do a switch with a capo, but I'm certainly allowed to dig a hole and try to get out myself, because I'm Chayecha Kodman. Your life comes before everyone else's, so I'm allowed to try to save myself. And now he directly addressed your question. In the present case, it might be argued that the father and his son should be considered the same person, thus permitting the father to bribe the kapo. And he goes at this at length in the Hebrew footnote, that there may be a halachic precedent to consider a father and a son or a parent and a child the same. And so by extension, if the father's allowed to save himself, even though it may lead to the death of somebody else, then he's also allowed to save his son if it may lead to the death of somebody else. He puts out that out as a possibility. But it doesn't help in this case, because these are two kids, they're not related, it's not a father and son. But Rabbi Zalz finds no definitive warrant for such a view, so he brings it up, which you often find in Tshuvot. They'll bring something up and they'll say, maybe, but it's not enough to go on. So that's a very interesting angle to take. So again, this question is, it's an amazing testament to this type of devotion to Torah that this 15-year-old kid had, that he felt that, again, this may not fit well or sit well with some people, but from in that worldview where Torah and an excellence in Torah is the highest value, or one of the highest values, then this made eminent sense to this boy. Because I'm not going to learn any Torah here in Auschwitz, and this guy already is a Talmud Chacham. Let's give him another chance to survive. He doesn't allow him to, and in the end, Rabbi, certainly there is a big difference between me and Moshele. For Moshele is a young scholar, diligent in studies, and the world will have use for him, but not for somebody as lowly as me. I am stupid and know nothing. I am worthless. Not the best attitude, but again, we can't judge people in Auschwitz.
He says that he saw all his family.
Right. He's the only one left. Right. Thank you. Already I've seen with my own eyes, especially my family. In what way am I better than they? If they died, why shouldn't I die? This is survivor guilt that we talk about. I was stunned, the rabbi says. I felt that a little more than a dear boy's tearful plea and my heart would break, but I did not give him my consent under any circumstance. I rebuked him a second time. Finally, after many entreaties and supplications, he left in great disappointment. My brother, consider for a brief moment this incident and what was said in heaven about the plea of this young boy, which came from deep inside his heart. I think they both perished, because it says about Rabbi Baruch, man, may God avenge his blood. That's the boy. And it also says about Moshe Rosenberg, who's the Torah scholar, may God avenge his blood. So neither of them made it out of Auschwitz in any case. Okay, it's time for Mincha. I thank you all for coming and for sharing this. And have a good evening. I'll see you for the